Welcome to Brighteon Broadcast News. It's Tuesday, November 14th, 2023. Thank you for joining me today. I'm Mike Adams. And the working title of today's episode is The Tipping Point of Anarchy, because I'm going to show you some things here today that will absolutely be disturbing, but they will underscore how quickly we are losing, or Western civilization is losing its grip on reality. It is sinking into the abyss of irrationality, of psychosis. It's as if all the false flags and the COVID bioweapons and all the psychological operations by the media, all of it has somehow just kind of reached a tipping point. And more than ever right now, people are losing their minds and everything is breaking down. In fact, yesterday, the internet broke for a while. I don't know, it was like 30 or 40 minutes, but Google was down, Facebook was down, YouTube was down, and our online store was even down for a short period of time. I don't even know what the cause of it was, but it was probably, as I've been saying recently, it's probably Dangerous Dan, the guy that breaks everything in your IT department, right? And as I said, every organization has a guy like that. But whatever the cause was, a large part of the internet broke. I mean, Cloudflare was down for a period of time. That's major. But what we are really witnessing here, I mean, things breaking, that's just a symptom. Even, in fact, runaway war is just a symptom. You know, runaway inflation is just a symptom. Crime in the streets, that's just a symptom. The underlying causes are the policies that our elected officials have pushed on us for generations, and it's not just Democrat policies, it's also a lot of things the Republicans did as well. These policies of not defending our nation, allowing the culture to be watered down, pushing Christian principles out of public schools, for example, while allowing, you know, runaway abortion or child murder, late term abortions, especially abortion up to the day of birth and so on. These kinds of policies, but money printing on top of that, and endless wars and coercion, and dumbing down the population instead of building up the people. This, the culmination of this is now here, and it's a hellscape. We are now living, if you're living in America, that is, we're living among a population of irrational, like frighteningly irrational and largely incompetent younger people, although again, there are exceptions to this, and especially those who are homeschooled, and especially those who grew up on farms and ranches and so on, and had to work with their hands, and there are exceptions, but by and large, especially the younger generation has been brought up with none of the skills that are required to sustain human civilization. No work ethic, no morality, right? No faith, no skills, no hands on anything. Just this attitude of entitlement combined with a certain level of apathy. Like, I don't care, give me my Starbucks. You know, like that's pretty much, that characterizes a lot of people in that generation. And as a result, our society has now crossed the threshold, the tipping point of anarchy, and things are breaking down, and they will continue to break down at an accelerated pace. And I want to show you a couple of videos here, actually three videos, that demonstrate this. And the first one comes to us from Todd Starnes, who tweeted this out, this urgent warning. He said, "We need help. This is a major interstate in Memphis shut down by gun-waving thugs. There's no law or order in our city. The Democrats will not protect us from the violence. Republicans in the state house won't do anything. We're left to fend for ourselves. Memphis has fallen to anarchy." Yeah. So let me play this video for you out of Memphis, and I'll talk over it while you watch this. Here we go. Now check out this car on the highway just doing donuts. And Todd Starnes tweets the following. "This is a major interstate in Memphis shut down by gun-waving thugs. There's no law or order in our city. The Democrats will not protect us from the violence. Republicans in the state house won't do anything. We are left to fend for ourselves. Memphis has fallen to anarchy." And there you go. Just cars doing donuts, driving off in the distance, shutting down the interstate. This is what anarchy looks like. It's lawless. Notice there's no police responding. Nobody. Oh, whoa. Here's another car. Now they're up, doing more donuts in the highway. It's not just a one-off thing. This person is very likely to smash into the barricade, I think. Or run over somebody else. Oh, a truck sneaks by. Yeah, that's interesting. Wow. So this is what you're going to see more and more in America's cities as the collapse accelerates. Wow. I told you the collapse of the cities is imminent. And the collapse of the rule of law is, of course, part of it. So, wow. There we go. Fascinating. All right. Gun-waving thugs. Okay, this next video shows the looting, also in Memphis, Tennessee. The looting, well, let me show you the video and I'll read the caption for you. All right, the caption says, several gas stations and a FedEx truck were looted and ransacked over the weekend in Memphis, Tennessee. Over 40 people were involved in these mass looting events over the weekend. No arrests have been made. George Soros is definitely getting what he paid for with his district attorney, Steve Mulroy. So here you go. This is what you're going to see in cities all across America. Grocery trucks will get ransacked, not just FedEx, not just UPS, Postal Service, Amtrak trains, just mass looting on parade. There you go. So this is happening in America, and nobody stopping it. So let me show you the looting of an Amazon truck. This video was circulating today. I'm not sure if it was filmed in the last day, but it may have been. In any case, it doesn't matter. This is what's happening in more and more places. Check this out. So here it is, the Prime truck. Oh, bunch of youth in there, jumping in there, looting the place, and with some commentary from the cameraman. Oh, here comes a kid, got a box of something. Maybe it's a box of toilet paper. Who knows? And there he goes running down the sidewalk. So this is also in America where delivery trucks just get ransacked and looted. All right, now I want to play a video for you that's also been circulating widely. This is a video of a kid's birthday party where, and we're talking like, I don't know, a four-year-old kid or something. And they're being handed cash and pistols, like, real-looking pistols, perhaps live guns. This is incredible. Check out this video. So here we go. Oh yeah, getting down with who's this kid? Is he dry humping the table? He's got a Glock in his hand. He's got cash. Oh, now the little baby, the infant, is picking up the Glock. Oh, waving it around with his finger on the trigger, of course, right there, ready to fire, you know, not knowing, of course, gun safety. And his older brother's cash and guns. And the whole family standing around there. Yeah, this is awesome. We got to train them early. You know, these are the skills they're going to need. I mean, is this insane or what? This is happening in America. I mean, do you have any hope of where our society is headed? That's what I'm talking about. The tipping point of anarchy in America's cities. Okay. And the looting, and the cars doing donuts on the highway, and this birthday party, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. Oh, I've got something else to show you. Yeah. Georgia County Commissioner, a Democrat, Felicia Franklin, was found passed out drunk in the streets and sitting in her own urine, according to some police body cam footage, and she just went to town on these cops. So check out this video, and remember that this is the woman who runs your elections, by the way. This is the woman, and this is the kind of person that stole the election in 2020. Take a look at this video.
You need to stop.
Felicia.
You're going to make it worse than what it needs to be.
Felicia.
Get him out of my face. I don't give a Get him out of my
stop
face.
It, Felicia.
You better. Get him out of this truck! Get him out of this truck! Get him the
As long as nothing
okay, I'm right here. I'm right here. I'm not going anywhere. What happened? She's spitting up. She's throwing up.
Hey, don't leave me.
I'm not leaving you. I'm not going anywhere.
You but
no. No, she's not. He's not making it worse.
All right. That's about all that I could stand. This is, you know, again, these are the people who run your elections in Georgia and other places. And this is, again, these are the kind of people that characterize the Democrat Party today. And not to mention Joe Biden, who is an embarrassment to the human race. And I think every rational person agrees with that. So we are headed for a level of like purge chaos that most people cannot possibly comprehend. People are snapping, systems are breaking down, and the dollar collapse grows ever closer. In fact, we have major breaking news on that front today. Maybe this should have been the title of this podcast. I got to bring this up for you. Moody's, the financial rating service, has now downgraded U.S. Treasury debt to negative. And this was covered by GB News, published on MSN.com. A U.S. economy warning has been issued by an expert, with Treasuries no longer safe following Moody's change in the outlook of Biden's government from stable to, quote, negative. The ratings agency downgraded the president's government on Friday, saying the U.S.'s fiscal deficits are expected to remain very large, meaning debt affordability will weaken significantly. So the agency, which provides risk assessment services for large firms and organizations, warned that continued political polarization in the U.S. government poses a risk as Congress, quote, will not be able to reach consensus on a fiscal plan to slow the decline of debt affordability. Now, what they're actually talking about there, debt affordability, is what it costs to pay the interest on the debt. And as we covered a couple days ago, that is now over $1 trillion a year, which means that the U.S. has to print money to pay the interest on the debt that it already owes. And so there's a similar story on this, but covered from RT, that I think has a more accurate headline. Horseman of the economic apocalypse. Friday's U.S. debt forecast has shocked traders and bankers. Credit ratings agency Moody's hit the panic button as the U.S. debt outlook takes a dive to negative. You know what? I just got to interrupt myself. I like that headline so much, I'm going to borrow that. I think I'm going to make that the headline of today's podcast, Horseman of the Economic Apocalypse. I mean, it's accurate. That is accurate. I may borrow that. Anyway, let's see. Right after the markets closed on Friday, Moody's Investor Service shifted its outlook on the government of the United States from stable to negative. Now, they held this announcement until after the markets closed, of course. Now, I want to read a paragraph from the story that explains who is currently buying treasuries or who holds them. Now, listen to this list carefully, because this is actually a list of everybody that's going to get burned. Just royally screwed, left with nothing, because treasuries are going to go to zero as the dollar goes to zero. I mean, hand in hand, what's the ability of the U.S. government to pay back treasury debt when the government has dissolved? The answer is zero. It's going to be a massive default. The United States of America will default on its treasuries. That day is coming, and it's accelerating towards us at a frightening pace. But here's the paragraph. Check this out. Commercial banks, which are major treasuries buyers, use them for regulatory purposes and collateral and for hedging interest rate risk. So, I mean, that's just for starters. So almost every bank across the country buys treasuries in order to maintain the level of deposits of, quote, assets that are required by the federal regulators. It's a scheme. You know, it's a federally enforced Ponzi scheme. The banks take your money, and then they actually can place a lot of risky bets on your money or loan it out to somebody else to earn money off that money. And then they have to maintain a portion of your deposit as treasuries in their bank to serve as collateral. So that forces the banks to buy treasuries, which helps, you know, keep the Ponzi scheme going a little bit longer. But continuing with this paragraph, pension funds, significant purchasers of treasuries, utilize them for long duration matching and collateral. All right, so pension funds are also going to, well, many of them, if they hold a lot of treasuries, they're going to go to zero when the treasuries go to zero. Now, from the story, the downgrade by Moody's prompts reflection on alternatives to treasuries, including consideration of Japan's government bonds. Japan's bonds are in worse shape than U.S. Treasury bonds, by the way. And Europe's bond market. Yeah, good luck, Europe. You know, Europe's economy is in shambles already because of Nord Stream, not to mention what's about to happen with the escalation of world war across Europe, you know, thanks to the U.S. trying to push everybody's buttons. Now, the higher cost of servicing debt because of heightened interest rates and larger or higher yields on treasuries, this is going to devastate America's corporations. And the reason why that is because of corporate debt. Corporations take on a tremendous amount of debt in order to, well, to buffer cash flow, to expand, sometimes just to cover losses, to cover downturns like during COVID or what have you. Corporate debt is a huge thing. Most corporations, almost every corporation, has a massive amount of debt, and nearly every public corporation especially. So from that story, this double whammy, talking about the debt downgrade, will send shockwaves through corporate debt, hitting the reset button at higher rates. In 2023, $500 billion of existing corporate debt is up for refinancing. So that means, you know, sometime this year, $500 billion of corporate debt has to be refinanced at much higher rates than where it was previously financed years ago. Because years ago, it was, you know, interest rates were zero or close to zero. Continuing to the story, comma, followed by a hefty $800 billion in 2024. That's corporate debt up for refinancing. And then $1 trillion in 2025. So what are interest rates going to be in 2024? And 2025, what will the yields be on U.S. treasuries? It's going to skyrocket. Refinancing is going to become so expensive that we're going to see a tidal wave of corporate bankruptcies across America over the next several years. Corporate bankruptcies, I mean big corporations, they're going to go under. WeWork just filed for bankruptcy, by the way, and that's just the beginning. So where this is going fiscally is not difficult to figure out. You've got the United States involved in two wars. Janet Yellen said, we can fund both wars. All we have to do is just keep printing currency. And so that's exactly what they're going to do. They're going to fund the Ukraine war, even though Ukraine has already lost. But, you know, they're going to still pump money into it because it's a really effective racket. And then now they're going to fund war in the Middle East and find ways to escalate that. In order to do this, they're going to print currency. As they print more currency, yields, treasury yields, are going to skyrocket because fewer and fewer countries out there will be interested in purchasing U.S. debt because, you know, what's the point of holding treasuries if the dollar keeps collapsing in value? You know, you can't earn enough in the yield to compensate for the drop in the value of the dollar because of too much money printing. So that means that bond prices are going to collapse. And this is going to be devastating to corporations, bondholders, debt holders. And on top of that, you're going to see central banks from other countries around the world, notably China, selling off more U.S. treasuries. I mean, China has already begun to do that at quite an astonishing pace. So they're probably going to escalate that. So then the question becomes, how does the U.S. find buyers for its debt when it needs to print more billions of dollars or trillions in order to fund more wars and more deficits and more welfare programs and corporate bailouts? That's going to be a big factor in all of this. It's going to be just like COVID. And at some point, I mean, here's where this is going. The federal government, well, the Treasury is going to print money with the Fed, obviously. I'll just use the term Treasury generically. The Treasury is going to print and distribute money at insane levels. You're going to see government printing and handouts to corporations all across the country, even to small businesses all across the country, and to consumers all across the country, like we saw with COVID. You know, you get a debit card and it'll have like $5,000 on it. You can spend on anything you want. And most people, of course, flittered that away on, I don't know, cigarettes and beer or whatever. that's what happened during COVID, or gambling, you know, online gambling or what have you. And eventually it's going to get so crazy that the IRS is going to be ordered to start refunding tax payments to the American people. So there's going to come a day, probably in the not too distant future, where you'll get a refund for what you paid last year in federal taxes. You'll get the entire thing back because they have to stimulate the economy to keep the system going a little bit longer as they print and print and print. And that's the only way they know how to do it, is just shove money down the throats of the consumers and the corporations across the country, kind of like an adrenaline shot into the heart to revive a heroin junkie that has whose heart has stopped beating. You know, it's like, well, too much stimulus, too much heroin. But what's the answer? Adrenaline, you know, jab it in there, pump it in there. Ah, you know, the zombie wakes up and is all freaking out. That's the U.S. economy now. It is a zombie economy. I mean, that's the U.S. economy now. It is a zombie economy. And it's going to take supernatural forces to keep it animated. Now, in fact, I have to give myself a little credit for another Health Ranger prediction that has come true. Remember when I said that illegal aliens would one day begin to flee America back to their home countries in South America? Remember that? I've said that quite a few times. Well, guess what? It's happening. Here's a story out of the UK Daily Mail. Here's the headline. Chicago is so unpleasant. Migrants are fleeing back to Venezuela after being dumped in shelters and refused jobs, with 20,700 border crossers so far bussed to Democrat-run sanctuary city. And the subheads, Illinois' harsh winters and lack of migrant infrastructure and ambivalent support from locals has made many asylum seekers go back home. Now, that sentence is astonishing. I mean, harsh winters, yeah. Have you ever been to Chicago in January? The wind and the cold together. The lack of migrant infrastructure. Well, isn't Chicago supposed to serve the citizens of Chicago first? I mean, why should they have all this infrastructure for illegals? They barely have infrastructure for the taxpayers of Chicago. Have you driven on Chicago's roads? I mean, Chicago's roads are so notoriously bad that if you have a small enough car, you can actually dip into a pothole, orbit around the pothole a few times with your car inside to build up enough momentum to get back out over the rim of the pothole so you can continue on the highway. That's how big the potholes are in Chicago. So they're complaining about lack of infrastructure for migrants. Yeah, well, join the club. There's hardly any infrastructure functioning in Chicago at all. But from the story, since August last year, 20,700 migrants have arrived in Chicago from Texas. Yes, Texas, our number one export now is illegals. The Lone Star State's governor, Greg Abbott, sent migrants to Chicago and other Democrat-run cities because of their proud status as sanctuary cities. Yes, I think this is hilarious. They offer enhanced protection against detention or deportation for undocumented migrants. Now, because of Illinois' harsh winters and, you know, lack of migrant infrastructure, many people who undertook the harsh U.S.-Mexico border journey actually turn around and go back home. So, let me get this straight. They come across the border to Texas. Texas rounds them up and puts them on a bus. The bus drives to Chicago. We let them loose in Chicago, and it gets cold. Then the migrants say, I'm out of here, and they go back to where? Not Texas. They go back to Venezuela. That's how bad Chicago is. People are like, I'm out of here. The whole country. Send me home to Venezuela. I'll take fascism over this insanity in Chicago, you know? Like, Chicago is so bad that it actually gives illegal migrants nightmares. Seriously, these people are like, I survived the Darien Gap. Yeah, they tried to rape me. They tried to rob me. I got malaria, almost drowned in the rivers. That was no problem. Got to Chicago. I'm out of here. That's how bad Chicago is. Well, I guess we have to thank Mayor Johnson there for making Chicago very unwelcoming to illegals, but also a nightmare for people who actually do live there, i.e. citizens of Chicago. Here's the takeaway from that story. Quote, the family said the failed journey to settle in the U.S. had not been worth it, despite the extreme poverty and an authoritarian regime they were living under in Venezuela. In other words, Chicago is worse than living in extreme poverty under an authoritarian regime. That's how bad Chicago is. And, oh, by the way, we have an emergency interview with Michael Yon today coming up here shortly. And Michael Yon told me recently, he said this during one of the interviews, he said that he's talked to the illegals as they're going through the Darien Gap. He's tried to warn them and say, hey, guess what? You think America is the land of milk and honey? This is your dream world? Reality check. You're not going to like where you're headed. You may want to reconsider what you're doing here. And sure enough, people are now fleeing America to get back to Venezuela. Hey, by the way, that reminds me, what do you think about Trump's new immigration plans? The New York Times did kind of a hit piece on Trump's plans. And I think the New York Times, of course, deliberately misrepresented what Trump wants to do. But let me run this by you here and see what you think. So Trump's big new immigration plan, or I should say, opposition to immigration plan, looks something like this. Oh, and he said in a recent speech, he said, quote, we will carry out the largest domestic deportation operation in American history. So number one, Trump is going to ban Muslim immigrants. You hear that? you're going to be banned from immigrating just by being a Muslim. So I guess you can be an atheist under Trump's plan and come to America. You can be a Satanist and still immigrate. But if you worship Allah, then you're not going to be allowed. Is that right? So it seems like he's going to ban immigration from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Syria, a bunch of other countries as well. He's going to block asylum claims because a lot of people show up at the border and, and they're told what to say, like, just say, I'm being persecuted at home, and then you get in. He's going to restrict asylum claims. He's going to engage in mass deportations. He's going to search the country for illegal immigrants with the goal of deporting millions of them every year. The New York Times claims this is going to be a, quote, an enormous expansion of a form of removal that does not require due process hearings. And he's going to retask local cops and National Guard soldiers in order to round up these people, illegals, for mass deportations. He's going to launch huge detention camps, new detention camps, to be filled with the illegals that are rounded up before they are booted out of the country. So Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, they're going to be involved in these new camps. He's going to terminate the granting of citizenship to babies that are born to illegal immigrants, and he's going to expand ideological screening. Well, okay, so first of all, ideological screening, give me a break. Build the wall, for starters, because nobody screens the ideology of the people walking across the border. Just, freaking build the wall. Can we start with that? Can we just stop the illegals from pouring in? That would be major right there. Now, what do you think about the rounding up of so-called, illegals or migrants or whatever label you use? What do you think about this idea that Trump is pushing of rounding them up and, I guess, processing them in large detention camps and then kicking them out of the country? Well, seriously, what do you think about that? Because to me, let me be clear. I'm completely opposed to illegal immigration. Don't get me wrong. But I'm fully supportive of legal immigration. As you know, I'm married to an immigrant. And I know a lot of legal immigrants who have done extraordinary things as contributors to America. And legal immigrants, when they go through the process and they are screened, and typically they want to come to America to enjoy the American dream, and they're willing to help promote it, to participate in it. You know, these aren't the people just crossing the border and saying, give me more welfare money, give me free everything, give me my Obama phone, you know, give me my free rent. No, these are people who want to work. They want to create. Many times they want to go to school. They want to get an education. They want to become engineers and scientists and whatever. They want to contribute to society. But my question about this idea of mass deportations and large-scale detention camps gets down to the question of, do we really want to turn America into some kind of massive police state? I mean, it's one thing to say that when illegals are arrested carrying out other crimes, like if an illegal steals a car and gets caught and you find out they're an illegal, yeah, boot them out. Or, you know, if they're involved in a home robbery or whatever, or they get arrested for violence or whatever, you find out they're illegal, boot them. But that's different than running around the country with a domestic immigration police force that is essentially looking at every person in a suspicious manner, every person who is not white, or I should say not white, well, yeah, pretty much not white, because they're going to be looking for Haitian illegals, who are mostly dark-skinned, as you know. They're going to be looking for Mexican illegals. They're going to be looking for all kinds of brown people. They're going to be looking for Middle Eastern brown people. But mostly brown people, some black people, not so many white people. We're going to have, apparently under Trump, a kind of bounty squad, like an illegal migrant bounty hunter squad or program that has what kinds of powers? You know, this is my question. If we're going to have a civil society, what kinds of powers do these people have? Can they just enter anybody's home at any time? And we think there's illegals in there. Can they just break down the door? Can they just bust into a business? Can they break into a school? Can they take children out of schools? Can they stop any of us on the street and say, show me your papers, show me your passport, prove you're an American? I mean, this is what disturbs me from a civil liberties point of view. What is this going to look like in practical terms? Now, again, I want to be clear. I am not at all opposed to deporting illegals that are arrested for crimes. And of course, I want to stop the pouring in of illegals. Absolutely. And any that the federal government has in custody right now who already came across the border, but they've got them in custody, they should boot them. But running around the country with some kind of like bounty hunter squads looking for illegals using what form of due process, what laws, what are the rules of evidence? What can these people do? I'm not sure that I'm cool with that. I'm not sure that I want to live in a police state society where all of us are subjected to, you know, on the spot searches of our vehicles. Like, what happened to the Fourth Amendment? I mean, what if you're driving down the highway? Like, I'm in my truck and suddenly the anti-immigration police or ICE officers or whatever pull me over. Like, we think you might be hiding illegals in your truck. Well, why do you think that? What's the basis of your suspicion? Oh, we don't have to have any basis. We're just going to search your truck. Well, no, I decline. You know, Fourth Amendment, get a warrant, you pricks, right? And then they're going to say, we don't need a warrant because Trump gave us, you know, whatever emergency powers. We can search your truck. We can search your back seat. We can search your rectum if we want to, right? I mean, this is what it's going to come to, like strip searching American citizens on the side of the road. You might be hiding a migrant in there. Who knows? And I can tell you where this is going next. This is so easy to see. I don't need a crystal ball. With the economic collapse and food inflation and the dollar collapse, you're going to see the federal government offering rewards, bounty rewards for American citizens who turn in illegals. So you're going to start to have Americans turning in their neighbors. You're going to have them turning in their coworkers. you're going to have Americans versus Americans, and that is going to create so much suspicion and violence and distrust and just chaos in the culture. And then also the other actual practical question in all of this, and I don't care if I take heat saying this, but who's going to do the labor in America? Seriously, who's going to do the construction? You know, who's going to deliver the gravel in the dump trucks? Who's going to pick the crops? Not to say that illegals only do these things, but obviously most of agriculture in California is actually powered by illegal immigrants picking the crops. You know, that's what ends up on your dinner plate. Who's going to do the labor? You can't tell me that, oh, the American people will take those jobs. No, they won't. Do you know any young Americans that are willing to pick strawberries? Come, don't make me laugh. There are none. No. Young Americans say, well, we only eat strawberries. We don't pick strawberries. That's for brown people. You know that? Because there is kind of a hierarchical, you know, strata of society that exists in America where especially young white liberals, they don't think they should ever have to work or manufacture anything, right? It's like, we don't make tennis shoes. We wear tennis shoes, you know, or maybe they don't even call them tennis shoes anymore, but whatever. We don't make fashion clothing. We consume fashion clothing, you know, let those slave workers in Bangladesh, you know, bang out all the textiles for us. There was a big strike in Bangladesh recently, by the way, over the labor wages, where all these big fashion brands, you know, where you pay $90 for a shirt, they pay some poor Bangladeshi worker, you know, like a dollar a day or something, or I don't know, maybe it's a couple dollars a day to make that shirt. And it's a total ripoff operation. But again, the youth in the West, especially in America, but also in Canada to a large extent, they don't think they should have to work. They're just consumers. We consume things. We don't make things. That's beneath us. You know, that's their attitude. And by the way, these detention camps that Trump wants to build. Yeah, he says he's going to bypass Congress because Congress will never approve the money. He's going to use the Pentagon money to run the camps. Do you understand what that is? It means these are going to be military concentration camps in America, holding people who in some cases used to be, you know, your neighbors, your workers. Now, look, I know there's a whole lot of illegal, violent criminals. Those people need to go. I completely agree. There's a whole lot of would-be terrorists and extremists who hate America, and they're coming into America as a staging area. They want to occupy, they want to destroy, they want to sabotage. I get it. We do need to get rid of those people, but we can't turn America into a police state. You know, you can't turn your neighborhood into a Nazi style show me your papers checkpoint system. Because what, you think you're saving America? No, you've lost America at that point. You've lost your freedom. If it's not even safe for you to drive around, walk around, go shopping without all these, you know, immigration police everywhere who have the power to take you and put you in a military concentration camp just because of the way you look in many cases. Oh, are you a little bit brown looking? Will it be safe to walk around on the streets if Trump pushes this plan? I tell you, as you can tell, I have issues with this plan. I have major issues with this. Now, there are elements of his plan that seem okay to me, such as, yeah, expanded ideological screening. Sure. But what about build the wall first, right? And like I said, I agree with deporting criminals if they are also found to be illegals, you know, kick them out. But don't turn our country into a show me your papers Nazi style police state. That would be worse. Now, if we do nothing, by the way, if we don't address this problem, America gets overrun by violent extremists and criminals. And in some cases, yeah, in some case, radical Islamic terrorists. So we can't do nothing. We have to start the process right now of building the wall and halting the influx. but there's no willingness to do that. Even under the presidency of Trump, there was no ability to get that done. And by the way, everything Trump suggests, Vivek Ramaswamy suggests a more radical version of that. So if Trump is like, we'll have mass deportations of illegals, Vivek would probably be like, yeah, and we'll set them on fire. You know, or Trump is like, we'll have detention camps. Vivek would be like, yeah, we'll set those camps on fire. You know, I mean, Vivek, he is very provocative. Everything he says is designed to, in effect, out-Trump Trump, which is a hard thing to do. But Vivek is actually in some ways doing it. But, you know, I'm not happy with Trump right now because of his stance on vaccines, Operation Warp Speed, and how close he is to Pfizer. And he's never resolved that. He has never pushed away from Pfizer. So one of my fears is that if Trump becomes president, we're going to have another pandemic. We're going to have Operation Warp Speed Part 2, more vaccine mandates. And now on top of that, an immigration police state. Show me your papers and you better be wearing a mask and you better take the jab. You know, it's going to be worse than the COVID 1.0. But there's also a part of me that has come to the realization nobody can save America from the tipping point of collapse. Not Trump, not RFK, certainly not Biden, not any one person. America's done. I mean, it's doomed. We're past the tipping point of being able to pull this nation back from the brink of self-destruction. I mean, that's just the simple, honest truth about where we are. Financially, it's almost over. $1 trillion a year, interest on the debt? How do you come back from that? Well, you certainly don't come back from that by printing trillions of dollars more each year and starting two wars and funding two wars and just saying you can print money to oblivion. That's not the way you solve it. I think the realization is that America is going to collapse. It will probably collapse under whoever's president from the next election, if we make it that far. I don't see us, there's no way in my mind that we make it to 2028. So I think this next election really just determines who's in the Oval Office when it all hits the fan, frankly. Do you want Trump to oversee the collapse? Do you want Biden to oversee the collapse? I don't know. I guess at least with Trump, he probably won't try to take away your Second Amendment, right? You're probably going to need your Second Amendment during any kind of collapse. But he might take away your neighbors if they happen to be, you know, people who never became citizens. Even though if they've been living there for 15 years and even working in America and, you know, not bad people, contribute to society, he's going to round them up, you know. That's going to happen if he becomes president. And so I've got a lot of concerns, obviously, about, well, I don't think there's anybody that can save us at this point. But thank God, cooler heads are prevailing in Israel, huh? Yeah. Yeah, here's a story out of Information Liberation. I got to show you this picture. This soldier, this Israeli IDF soldier who is apparently gay or LGBTQ something, he's in Gaza and he unfurls the LGBT flag. Take a look at this photo. So here we go. Here's a soldier that unfurls the LGBT flag in Gaza after Israel has bombed and killed over 11,000 civilians, killing countless thousands of women and children, bombed hospitals, schools, universities, refugee camps, water treatment facilities, just bombed them indiscriminately in acts that are clearly violations of the so-called rules of war. This soldier unfurls an LGBT flag that says, quote, in the name of love. Isn't that so loving? So loving. It's just very thoughtful of IDF soldiers to really, you know, echo the feeling of love standing over the bodies of Palestinian babies blown to bits and to unfurl the LGBT flag in order to make sure that LGBT claims dominion over Gaza. That if only those babies hadn't been bombed to bloody little bits, well, then the LGBT IDF could come in with scalpels and mutilate their genitalia and convert them to transgenders. See, that's in the name of love. That's what the IDF stands for. And there's another photo of the LGBT flag with the Star of David Israel flag in front of a tank. The Merkava tanks, I think, is what they're called. Yeah. Tanks and love and child mutilations and LGBT conquering the territory. Yeah, we killed your women and children. We blew you to bits. We destroyed your universities and hospitals. And we come in the name of love and progressivism. Yes. This is progress, right? It must be progress. I mean, the flag has multiple colors in it. It's very colorful. It's a rainbow. And then someone who supports all this tweeted out, under Hamas, being gay means death. Israeli Yoav Atzmoni wanted to send a message of hope. That's the soldier carrying the flag. So under Hamas, being gay means death. But doesn't this person realize that under Israel, being Palestinian means being bombed to death? I mean, come on. He's trying to compare the death of being gay to the mass indiscriminate bombing of all civilians of all persuasions by Israel. This is some sick stuff. Super sick stuff. So this story from Information Liberation points out that pride flags have been hoisted in many areas around the world where the West has conquered local people. So the pride flags have become symbols of occupation to millions of people throughout the world. The U.S. hoisted a pride flag in Afghanistan during their occupation. NBC News did a whole story on that. The importance of a pride flag in Afghanistan. Yeah, because, you know, mutilating Afghani babies is a really important Western value. And they also put up murals of George Floyd, of course, you know. And that whole story of George Floyd is a complete fiction, the official narrative. So here we go. Yeah, first we bomb you, then we come in the name of love to convert your children. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I have a series of suggestions for the IDF. I think if you really want to represent the values of the LGBT Western progressivism, it's very important. You need to, number one, paint your tanks in bright rainbow colors. That will make sure the enemy knows the values that you're bringing to them to rescue them, obviously, from Hamas. So paint your tanks in bright rainbow colors. Secondly, make sure that all IDF soldier uniforms and helmets, especially the helmets, you could just start with the helmets, just make the helmets rainbow colors. Put yellow right up on top with the other colors of the rainbow. And again, that would send a very strong message. We are here in the name of love to rescue you from Hamas. So rainbow helmeted soldiers, and then have rainbow uniforms. To make sure that everyone can see the important work that the IDF is doing in the name of LGBT. And then I guess you could just combine them and just be like, IDF LGBT. You know, Israeli Defense Force LGBT. And I guess you could have strap-on sex toys on the soldiers too, right? I mean, like, they should be running around Gaza with dildos strapped to their hips, I think. That would be more appropriate. In the name of love, we're here to liberate you, with the rainbow helmets and the strap-on dildos and their service rifles and the LGBT flags and the rainbow tanks. Only then will I believe they're truly committed to the message of LGBT justice for our world. Anything other than that, I'm not buying it. Now, by the way, on a sad note, a more serious and sad note, I want to play just 37 seconds here of an interview with a Palestinian doctor. His final interview, a young doctor, completed medical school, is actively working on patients in Gaza, and an Israeli bomb struck his home, killed him and his father on November 12th, so just 2 days ago. I want you to see this interview because there are real people whose lives are being destroyed here. Check this out.
Why don't you go with your family south?
And if I go, who treats my patients? They are not animals. They have the right to receive proper health care. You think I went to medical school and for my postgraduate degrees for a total of 14 years, so I think only about my life and not my patients? I'm asking you, ma'am, you think this is the reason why I went to med school? To think only about my life?
All right, that doctor is now dead, blown to bits. Good thing the IDF comes in the name of love with the LGBT flags, you know, to make everything right again. If only that doctor had been, you know, progressive enough to embrace transgenderism, then he wouldn't have had to be blown to bits. I mean, these are some sick, twisted things that are happening, folks. That's why I struggle to find the right words to condemn the mass bombings of hospitals that continues right now. It's sometimes I have to resort to some sick, twisted satire because this is so far beyond words, I can barely describe it. And I'm not the only one who's sick of this, by the way. I want you to see this next video, which is, it features what looks to be an Orthodox Jewish rabbi speaking at an event and saying, Judaism, yes, Zionism, no. That's his message. This is a really important message and a very powerful message. It's over 2 minutes, but I want to play this for you because it's critical that we understand that, first of all, the nation of Israel does not represent Jews or all Jews. It doesn't represent Judaism. And the government of Israel has been taken over by Zionism. And most Jews are not Zionists. And many Jews reject Zionism, which at its core is a racist, genocidal philosophy, by the way, Zionism is. And so this is why you are seeing Jewish rabbis in America and around the world rising up right now and with great courage speaking against the ongoing genocidal bombings of Gaza that continue to be carried out by the IDF. You need to hear this. You need to understand and make that distinction. Not all Jews are in favor of Israel. In fact, most Israelis hate Netanyahu. And they hate him even more now because of what he's the path that he has put Israel on. So Netanyahu is not popular in Israel. He's not popular with Jews. Zionism is not endorsed by most Jews around the world. I would say the vast majority of both Israelis and Jews all over the world reject what Netanyahu is doing right now with Israel, right now, to Gaza. So don't blame Jews for this. This is not Judaism. These are not the Jewish people that are carrying this out. These are genocidal Zionists that are hated and despised by most Jews. So watch this video to understand more.
We have to remember, the state of Israel is not a Jewish state. It is a criminal state. You may call it a Zionist state, but never call it a Jewish state. Yes, yes, we desperately need a ceasefire. But a ceasefire is way not enough. We have to realize and we have to understand, if we are truly concerned for the safety and security of all, then we have to understand and realize what is the root cause of all what is happening now. It's not a difference of religion. We have differences of religion for the longest time. And Jewish people live in peace in Palestine. A minority of Jewish people were respected and protected by the majority of Muslims. Why? How? Because we were brotherly in peace and harmony until this political movement of Zionism came in, misrepresented the Jewish people, and destroyed that peace that exists. In order to have a future, we have to stop the cause to the problem, and we have to stop this occupation of Palestine in its entirety.
Judaism, yes. Zionism, no.
Judaism, yes. Zionism, no.
The state of Israel must go.
The state of Israel must go.
Zionism, no.
Zionism, yes. Zionism, no.
The state of Israel must
All right, wow. What a powerful, I mean, even historic speech there. And I want to be clear about something, too. Criticizing Israel does not mean you support Hamas. You know, it's very easy. I've seen a lot of people engaging in a lot of intellectual dishonesty saying that anybody who protests against Israel is a Hamas supporter. That is not at all the case. I don't support Hamas. But I absolutely reject what Israel is doing to Palestinian civilians right now. Absolutely. I also reject what Hamas did on October 7th. See? Because I consistently condemn violence against innocent people, no matter who's carrying it out. But there's a lot of people out there that selectively support genocide as long as it's being carried out by their tribe, their team, their side. And that's intellectually dishonest. But understand, we are headed for escalation. Regardless of what you think about the current sides or factions or who's involved or what their motivations are, because admittedly, it is a very, very complex situation with a complex history, complex belief systems, and all kinds of false flags and disinformation flying around. It's hard to sort it all out. It's hard for any of us to sort it out. That's why we have to rely on core principles. Principles like, hey, let's not bomb and murder children. Let's not bomb hospitals. You know, people say, well, there might be tunnels under the hospitals. There's tunnels. If there's you still don't bomb hospitals. What if there's tunnels under a hospital, you know, in Los Angeles, and you think there's terrorists in the tunnels? Do you bomb the hospital? No. No, you don't. You go into the tunnels and you root out the terrorists. That's what you do. You don't bomb the hospital to the ground. It's absurd. It's crazy. But no matter which side you support, if any side, if we can't find a way to live together as different people and different ethnicities and different nations in peace without bombing each other, then we're gone. I mean, ask yourself this simple question. If the whole world acted like Israel, where would we be? What would the world look like if every nation said, well, we have the right to bomb anybody we want. We have the right. We think there's terrorists in your nation, in your hospitals, in your apartment buildings. We're just going to start bombing indiscriminately. If every nation did that, what would the world look like? It would be a collapsed hellhole, which is, of course, sort of where it's headed anyway. But that's because of these kinds of activities by, you know, irrational, insane lunatics in the State Department of the United States, in Netanyahu's government, in Biden's administration. And many other examples like Trudeau in Canada, you know, complete lunatic, total psychopath, right? It's these kind of people. And don't even get me started on the leaders of Western Europe. Those people are mentally ill. I mean, it's like there's been, I don't know, too many kings and queens inbreeding or something through the history of European leaders. And they've all turned into psychopathic entitled morons or something. Yeah, that is the way I feel about a lot of those European leaders. Now, I'm not talking about the European people. The European people are amazing, especially the Dutch. The Dutch are awesome. Dutch farmers are the best. I love the Dutch farmers. But man, the Dutch politicians are lunatics. And the Dutch farmers agree with me on that point, by the way. But the summary of all of this today, the U.S. is headed for a tipping point of anarchy. Systems are breaking down. Rationality is breaking down. The financial system is breaking down. U.S. debt has been downgraded to negative. The Treasury is going to have more and more difficulty selling off U.S. debt. And the cost to service the debt is over $1 trillion a year, and it's going to explode. We are now in the accelerating chapter of the end times. We are literally watching in real time the complete self-immolation of Western civilization. We're watching the West set itself on fire and burn itself to death right before our very eyes, even as we live within its bounds. This is what we're witnessing. It is nothing less than that. Understand what you're seeing, what you're experiencing. That's the only way that you can navigate it. And if we get through this without World War III, without nuclear weapons being launched, consider us to be incredibly blessed, because, you know, that's where things are going. And of course, at the same time, massive illegal immigration flooding into America, and a lot of questions about who's going to be president after the 2024 election and what they might do, what other forms of tyranny will be brought down upon us. We're going to be lucky to make it through this. Now, we're going to jump into the interview with Michael Yon, but let me plug a couple of sponsors that could help you get through this. The first one is BeReady123.com. BeReady123.com. It's about preparedness. They've got the solar generators. If you go to the website, BeReady123.com, you'll see the specials, the deals that they have on the packages with solar panels, solar generators, with that have the onboard lithium batteries and the inverters and charge controllers. This is a way to be able to function even when the power grid goes down. And I think that having a backup power solution is absolutely necessary. So if you don't already have a solution, avail yourself of that solution right there. BeReady123.com. And then in terms of the financial collapse, the dollar collapse, well, the debt blowout that's coming, I interview a lot of financial guests, and I study this almost every day in terms of monitoring news headlines and looking at the financial stories and so on. That's why I cover a little bit of that every single day. The very best strategy for insulating yourself against the collapse of the value of the dollar is to put assets into things that hold value and that are hard assets that you can have as a form of self-custody. And that list, as you've heard me say many times, is gold and silver and land. And then more recently, privacy-oriented crypto, even though it's not physically real, it is very usable. And if it's privacy-oriented, then no one knows that you have it and you can use it with privacy intact. And Monero is by far the best crypto in that space. But Firo, F-I-R-O, is about to launch some major new innovations, probably early 2024, that I think could also be a game changer for Firo. So gold and silver are key to this. Now, I don't recommend speculation. I'm not saying gold is going to hit $5,000 an ounce. I'm just saying that gold and silver preserve the value, whereas currencies, fiat currencies, keep losing value every day. If you had invested in gold in like 1990 with the dollars back then, you would find that the gold has skyrocketed in value. I think it was what, like $250 an ounce or something back then, or maybe even closer to 200. Now it's $2,000 an ounce. So gold has amplified its value in terms of dollars, while the dollars have lost value. Since 1990, how much value have dollars lost? Tremendous amount of value. You know, you could buy a car in 1990 for what, like 10 grand, and that same car now might be $60,000 or something like that. The dollar's lost value, gold has held value, and silver has held value, and I believe they will both continue to hold value because of their intrinsic properties. Our sponsor in that space, which is a company that you can trust, is the Treasure Island Coins and Precious Metals Company. You can find them at metalswithmike.com, and they will deliver physical gold and silver into your hands, guaranteed, insured, discreetly, or they will vault it for you in insured, guarded, well-protected, high-security vaults. And they can also vault your gold or silver for an IRS-approved IRA program. So if you want to get into gold and silver as kind of an insurance policy against currency losses, then this is a great option to consider. Go to metalswithmike.com. You can check out their real-time pricing on their website. And please understand, they don't pay me any affiliate commission whatsoever. I don't earn anything on the gold and silver sales. They are just a regular flat fee sponsor that helps support our network, because we have such considerable costs with bandwidth, especially on Brighteon.tv and Brighteon.com, serving out, you know, petabytes of bandwidth every month now. The bandwidth bill is pretty substantial, so that does help fund our operation. But so they do help support our network. But just to be clear, I wouldn't recommend somebody unless I use them myself. I recommend them to my family members and friends. If anybody calls me and says, you know, where should I go to get gold and silver? I point them to Treasure Island. It's very simple. metalswithmike.com. You can trust them. They do a great job and they have excellent customer service, and they'll be happy to answer your questions. So with all of that, let's jump into the interview with Michael Yon, just recorded a few hours ago with some urgent messages about the ongoing invasion of the United States of America with illegals. Check it out, and I'll be back with you tomorrow with another interview and more updates then. Take care. All right, welcome to today's emergency interview here on Brighteon.com. I'm Mike Adams. We're joined with an impromptu interview, completely unscheduled, but absolutely necessary, by Michael Yon, the international war correspondent and, of course, the world traveler. Last time I talked with you, Michael, by the way, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on today.
Thanks, Michael. I'm in Guatemala City right now, surrounded by this place is filled with volcanoes, all active.
Oh, wow. Yeah, there's about to be a volcano erupting in Iceland. And isn't there also a volcanic eruption in is it in Italy right now as well?
Oh, I don't know, but I'm happy not to be there if one of those is about to pop off.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like there's a lot of geo activity taking place right now. But the reason that you joined me today, and by the way, thank you for joining me, and I'll give out your website here in a second, but you wanted to share with us your analysis of not just what's happening between Israel and Gaza or Hamas or the Palestinians, but also how that's impacting us in the United States. There were major protests, even in Austin, Texas, as you saw. Looks like, I don't know, 100,000 people, 10,000. I couldn't tell exactly. It could be anywhere. It could be any of those numbers or more. But a lot of people were marching in Austin, Texas over the weekend with the Palestinian flags. And I saw some Jewish people posting that they feel all freaked out and the Jews are all running out to buy guns. I'm like, what, you didn't already own one? Come on. But yeah. I mean, Michael, what is your big picture take of the escalation that appears to be happening and what it means for all of us?
Yeah, that's interesting, by the way, that you said that, Michael. You're a super prepped person. Those of us who are actually ready don't need to go do anything. You know,
right. Got my gun on my hip right now. Yeah, I mean, come on.
Exactly. And we're like, okay, here we are. And so okay, very interesting. Let's rewind the tape, by the way, to Fallujah. And this is very similar. I see what's happening now with Gaza is very similar to what happened in the Iraq war with Fallujah. And this is important. You know, there was basically two major wars in the latest Iraq war that we were in. There was the invasion part of it, and then it sort of drifted into a very serious insurgency, right? It was quite serious, and we took thousands of casualties, right? I was there for a lot of it. So we had that first part, and then in March of 2004, four contractors were killed in Fallujah. They worked for Blackwater, one of whom was Scott Helvenston, the youngest Navy SEAL in history. He made it through BUDS at 17 years old. And some people say that's nonsense, but it's absolutely true, and they can find it online. I went to high school with Scott. We played on the same football team. We used to work out together in the same gym together. And so I knew Scott quite well. And the next day after that, and so he went off into SEALs, and I went Green Berets. So we left the same high school, and we took a Y on those paths. And then the next day after Scott was killed, rest in peace, one of my Green Beret teammates was killed, who was still on active duty, Richard Ferguson. So I went to both of their funerals. Scott's funeral was in Florida. Richard's was in Colorado. And there were SEALs and Green Berets, SEALs at Scott's funeral and Green Berets at Fergie's funeral. And I knew a lot of them who were saying, you know, the war is getting out of control. And it's going into an insurgency and that I should get over there. And I'm like, I'm not going there. But at that point. And so after Scott was killed in Fallujah, those four contractors were killed that worked for Blackwater, hanged off the bridge. The United States went in there hardcore and killed more than 1,000 people in Fallujah. Now, keep in mind, up to that point, this is very similar to what's happening in Gaza. Up to that point, Fallujah actually had been mostly peaceful. Not that Gaza has been, but Fallujah, believe it or not, the city of mosques, they call it, had been mostly peaceful. And then that happened. Many of the people in Fallujah were also upset and were ready to turn over many of the killers, right? But instead, the United States rolled up the cannons, rolled up the airstrikes, went in there, killed at least 1,000 people. How was that responded to by the rest of the world? You had Muslims from North Africa rolling in. You had, at Scott's funeral, by the way, There were people, there were media from all over the world. It was unbelievable. Even really? From, oh yeah, parked, I was at his mother's house with one of our mutual friends. We were all high school friends. And we were with, there was journalists parked around her house. It was unbelievable. All the way from Japan, everywhere. It was just, it was a zoo. It, and at the funeral as well, it was disgusting. And so the bottom line is people from all over the world flooded into Iraq. I mean, it was the Star Wars cafe of jihadists, right? People from Northern Africa, all over the Middle East, all over different parts of Iraq became active who weren't active before. We had people come in from the United States. We had people come in from Europe. So the war increased dramatically after the after our response to the murders of the four contractors. And so so then through 2004, the war increased. And then finally, at the end of 2004, the United States launched another attack called Operation Phantom Fury. And at this point, that's when I realized, hey, this is a full-blown insurgency. And, you know, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld was saying, no, they're dead-enders or whatnot. And as somebody who's seen a lot of war, I'm like, no, no, no. This is clear signs of insurgency. So I flew over to Iraq, and I was not there for that second attack at Phantom Fury. I came at the very end. But Phantom Fury killed, again, just devastated Fallujah. The war exploded from then. When I landed in Baghdad, there were so many firefights going on and bombs dropping and everything else and artillery firing. I was like, wow, this is even worse than CNN makes it out. I was actually, I was surprised at how kinetic it was. And I mean, it was loud, you know, just 24/7, right? It was, so now we're talking 2004, December. So those who were stationed in Baghdad at that time know what I was talking about. It was very loud. And so from there, I went off to other battle zones, and I just did a tremendous amount of combat in that war, and I became very familiar with it. And I mean combat, not war. There's war correspondents that mostly stay in hotel rooms, and then there's combat correspondents who are real combat correspondents who are like 1% of the actual war correspondents. So don't get those confused. You don't meet too many actual combat correspondents. You meet a lot of war correspondents, but you don't meet very many combat correspondents. So I spent a lot of time in combat. That's what I did. And the New York Times and the U.S. Army said I did more time in combat than anybody there, right? And that was when I was just getting warmed up. I was just getting limbered up when they published that in the New York Times. What I'm getting to is I knew that war intimately as time would unfold. And I knew many of the people that we were killing and capturing would often say that the ones who survived and then we captured would often say they were there because of Fallujah. They came from places like Algeria. They came from places like Sudan. They came from all Yemen. They came from all over the place because of Fallujah, right? And go ahead, sir.
Well, and yeah, the number of deaths that you're referring to in Fallujah is a tiny fraction of the number of civilians that have been killed in Gaza.
Yes. That's why what's happening in Gaza is like supersized from Fallujah, right? This is like, I don't know how many have been killed in Gaza because, you know, both sides lie like crazy. You know, the Israelis lie just as much as Hamas. I mean, let's face it, no side can be believed. But what we can see from some of the satellite imagery is that parts of Fallujah are being flattened, right? Now, again, on the scale of the earth, this is a and on the scale of war, it's actually quite tiny. On the scale of Gaza, if you're there, it's absolutely shattering. I mean, it's a local genocide is what it actually is. And so when you say that, people go, oh, you're pro Hamas. Not at all. I realize how dangerous they are very much. I've had a lot of friends shot and killed and blown up by these guys, right? Not just Hamas, but you know, other species of these jihadists, right? And including Al-Qaeda and whatnot. And anyway, the bottom line is this is going to grow. Wars are inherently unpredictable. Anybody that, you know, like say Ukraine says, hey, this war will be over in six, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. When they say it'll be over in six months, it's like you just discount it. I don't care if you've been in the military 30 years and served in 50 wars. If you're saying you know when this war is going to end and how it's going to end, I don't even listen anymore. It's talk to the hand, right? And so nobody knows. Wars are inherently unpredictable. They do two things that are predictable. They grow and they get out of control. That's what wars do. And they get out of control in very unpredictable ways.
So let's talk about the possible vectors of escalation. As far as we know, the bombings have not stopped, although there's talk of a possible a temporary ceasefire, maybe in exchange for some hostages, for example. That might happen. But we've also, we saw yesterday, the Israeli war cabinet voted to wage a full attack on Lebanon or on Hezbollah. And Netanyahu has said no to that. I guess Netanyahu wants to keep this a single front war, obviously, where he has more of an advantage. If Hezbollah gets, you know, strongly involved, you know, that's a whole nother front, not to mention Turkey. But where do you think the vector of escalation is going to, you know, burst through the seams next?
Unpredictable. It will burst. You know, one person that you might want to invite on is Joseph Humeier. In fact, I asked six people to fly to Guatemala for a meeting, and one of those was Joseph. Joseph is an expert on this stuff and the nexus with South and Central America and North America with Hezbollah, Hamas, and others. It's very interesting. Most of the people coming through the Darien Gap now are actually from Venezuela. There are a lot of Hamas and mostly Hezbollah in Venezuela, a lot, many. In fact, it's interesting when you talk with Joseph about this. We, when he flew to Guatemala last week, we talked a couple of days straight about it. And the interesting, there actually is a place in Syria where they speak Spanish, right? And almost nobody probably knows that because they lived here first and then they went back to Syria. There's a huge connection.
This is critical. I wanted to point this out that I think most Americans might easily mistake many of these people for Venezuelans or South Americans as they're crossing the border because they're fluent in Espanol. But like you said, they are Hezbollah organized in Venezuela and then moving across the U.S. border. So very easy for them to maneuver in that way, again, because of even, you know, physical features that can look similar to the untrained eye, correct?
Oh, definitely. They got the same body. I mean, they grew up in Venezuela. I mean, so they're completely native. They didn't just learn Spanish. They grew up speaking Spanish. And so, Right. And interestingly, also, there are actually many Jews like that as well. For instance, here in Guatemala, it's very pro-Israeli and pro-Jewish. Guatemala is, believe it or not. I had dinner with an Israeli businessman the other night. I was with him in the afternoon, and then we met for dinner. And you know, there's a big Star of David in downtown Guatemala City. It's probably 15 feet tall in a traffic circle. Wow. Yeah, and they named a street here called Calle Jerusalem, Capital de Israel. So Jerusalem Street, city of capital of Israel, right? And anyway, you know, actually the murder rate here in Guatemala is quite high, and there's a lot of crime there. Like as we walk around town, there was two armed guards in front of a McDonald's. I mean, with like proper weapons, right? And so I asked this Jewish businessman, I said, you know, do Jews get attacked here much? He said, actually, no, we're respected here a great deal. If a robber comes to you and you say you're Jewish, there's a chance he'll just apologize and leave you alone, actually, which is quite strange. Anyway, but I mean, what I'm getting to is there throughout Central and South America, there are a lot of sub ecosystems of people that people don't actually realize are here, and including a huge amount of Hezbollah. And they're totally dialed in. They have networks all over the place throughout the United States and Canada, of course, Mexico, and where I'm at now, Guatemala. They're all around. And so it's no problem for huge numbers of people to get from anywhere in the world into the United States. And they do every single day.
Okay, so I want to talk about that in a second, about what you think may be happening in the USA based on all of these can we say in some cases at least radicalized migrants or, you know, illegals crossing the border. But first, what's your sense of how successful the leaders of Middle Eastern countries may be, such as Turkey or Jordan or even Egypt at some point, but most definitely Lebanon, that the political leaders, will they be able to resist the calls for war that are being raised by their own people? For example, Turkey with Erdogan there, you know, his population is almost entirely Muslim and they want war. And Erdogan has really had to walk a thin line. You know, he has to appease his population, but also not declare a massive war on Israel, or maybe Turkey would start getting bombed by the U.S. for, you know, who knows? But what's your take on that? Are there vectors of stability that can prevent the escalation, or is it eventually just going to blow?
More likely, my guess, and this obviously is a guess, is that it will blow. I'm just watching, getting a feel for the system. And of course, I spent years in that part of the world and you know, kind of am dialed into that whole sort of area and the many ecosystems that are ready to blow. For instance, Turkey. By the way, Turkey has Erdogan has a close relationship with Bukele in El Salvador. Iran has a very close relationship with Venezuela, as does CCP, as does Russia, right? So, I mean, there's so many connections. It can blow in so many different ways and for so many different reasons, right? It can be just a mistake. It can be, you know, you can clearly see that our so-called government is itching for war and wants war and is trying to create casus belli with Iran, right? I mean, by the way, this is very important. There are other aspects unfolding here. For instance, the Panama Canal, regardless of everything else, is very low on water, right? That's a problem because the Panama Canal is absolutely vital for the United States. And Panama itself is very unstable right now and is going just in the directions that I've said on your show many times. I've predicted many times that I thought Panama eventually will be taken by the CCP. And that's what's happening clearly right now. Now, you saw that shipwreck in the Suez Canal, the accident. And so now when you've got the Panama Canal going the way that it is, which, you know, that thing at this rate, the way it's drying up, I don't even know what it's going to look like by February or March,
no
you know,
kidding.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, there, you,
right.
you wouldn't believe
be usable.
There are tens of thousands of trees above the waterline in Lake Gatun now, Gatun Lake. I was just out there twice on the lake looking at those. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's just like late. Trees that haven't seen air for over 100 years are now towering, you know, above the water because the lake is so low. Now, you saw the shipwreck in Suez Canal. Imagine Panama and Suez accidentally having another accident there. Straits of Hormuz, Malacca, other places, Bosphorus, right? I mean, there's many choke points. I mean, just Suez and the Panama Canal at once. I mean, that's arteries of trade,
right.
Big time. I mean, this can have massive
military
effects.
Projection.
United States has, you know, the Panama Canal, since it opened in 1914, has been absolutely vital to the United States. And, you know, because otherwise we have to have complete different we have two major oceans, you know, at our shores, right? So
right.
That's one of the reasons we have to have, you know, a very powerful Navy. That's one of the reasons, right? But one of the, you know, instead of having, you know, two gigantic separate Navy forces, we have the Panama Canal. But are we going to be able to get our ships through the canal? Actually, we've committed a lot of our naval forces over into the region where they can be blown out of the water. You know, yeah. I mean, and this can happen, obviously.
In fact, I wanted to ask you about this. We were told from Pentagon sources that in the last, I think, 48 hours, that in the eastern Mediterranean Sea area, where at least, well, there are two strike force groups in that area. One is in the eastern Mediterranean, as I understand it, that a helicopter was lost and five military members were killed. And they say it's a training exercise. Now, I'd like your reaction to that. But also, I've heard from other sources there are for certain there are special forces operators on the ground in Gaza taking part in the fighting in Gaza. That is U.S. military service members, probably demolitions experts blowing up tunnels and things like that. But what do you think about this and the helicopter, you know, accident?
Well, I don't have any specific knowledge about special operations in Gaza. And if I did, I would not say a word. I mean, because that basically would be family and friends, right? So,
yeah. Right.
And now this helicopter crash, rest in peace to our service members, you know, training accidents. We know how that goes, especially with special operations. You know, things are called training accidents all the time.
Right. But why would the U.S., I mean, yeah, you just said your disclaimer, and I respect that. But why would the U.S. even consider, if they're doing it, why would they consider putting U.S. military members on the ground where they could be taken out? It's almost like this could be a vector for escalation, you know, especially if one of them gets captured and then, you know, paraded around as a POW. Something like that would be horrifying.
I think the United States government would wish that to happen. I mean, it's very clear that this is not the government that our grandparents lived with, right? This is a beast. It's clearly working to destroy the United States. the open, we don't have borders anymore. You know, my good friend, Todd Bensman, he's a border expert, and he often will call it border crisis when we're talking together. I'm like, stop. We have no border and there's no crisis. This is a war. This is an invasion. This is no time for political correctness. We're being killed, and it's being done by our government. It's our government. Our flags are in those camps in the Darien Gap. I mean, I'm there. I'm in the camps. Our flags are, I've photographed them, made video. I've taken people, congressmen into the camps and that sort of thing. You know, our government is openly doing this. They're not even hiding it. They say it if people will just stop and listen. You know this, but most people don't.
So what you just said is extraordinary, thinking that the United States government, especially Mayorkas, who I think recently testified that there's no problem at the border whatsoever. Yeah, no problem, because it's going exactly as you wanted it to go, which is a total invasion of the United States, right? But if the U.S. is willing to take these actions that, that stand in contradiction to the interests of the American people, talk about Netanyahu for a moment. And is Netanyahu, who was never popular, he had, you know, 20-something percent of the vote. Most Israelis hate this guy, right? But is he pushing Israel into actions that are also very potentially dangerous or destructive to Israel's future?
That guy's a straight up enemy, Netanyahu. You know, years ago, I used to like Netanyahu, and my Israeli friends would say, are you crazy? How can you like this man? And now I understand what they were talking about. They were right. And, you know, he's a member of the World Economic Forum. That's all you need to know right there, right? I mean, he's openly a member of the World Economic Forum. What else is there beyond that? He's openly pushed the jab that Israelis take it. You know, he openly says that he negotiated special deal with Pfizer to do this. You know, there he is with the, you know, apparently, you know, the needle to the arm. Is it real or not? I highly doubt Netanyahu actually took a real death jab. But he certainly encouraged a lot of Jews to do it, and a lot of other Israelis as well, right? And one thing a lot of Americans and others don't realize is Israel does not represent Jews, period, right? Any more than the United States government represents Christians. It just does not, right? And Israel is not Judaism. There's a lot of Jews, including many that I know, that wish Israel would just completely evaporate. They're more hardcore about it than I am. For years, I supported Israel, and now, you know, at great personal cost. And now I've grown quite chilly to Israel. I mean, I'm just not going to stand. I'm sorry. I'm not all in on a genocide. I'm just not going to go for it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you and I and many of us in alternative media have raised concerns over this continued bombing of civilian targets, you know, hospitals, for God's sake. And refugee camps. And, you know, the argument that we hear from a lot of people is, well, Hamas might be hiding in those hospitals. That's why we had to bomb the hospitals. And I'm thinking, well, does that mean, you know, if Hamas is hiding in New York City, we're going to carpet bomb New York City? Or if Hamas is, or if a school shooter is hiding in a school, do you carpet bomb the entire school and kill all the other children to get the shooter? I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. Even from a military perspective, it doesn't make any sense. There's something else going on here, right?
Yeah, it doesn't. You know, and this is a discussion I've had, you know, probably 1,000 times over the years, because it's something that I've lived in the wars. And people from afar would constantly say, well, just torture them and this sort of thing. I'm like, no. You know, the thing is, we could go down the torture rabbit hole another time. But the bottom line is doing this creates more enemies. It creates more casualties. It creates more wars. It'll suck in Turkey and others, and the war will widen. And the United States is weak. It's not like it used to be. I'm looking at this from a broader perspective. I'm watching our military be weakened by the day. I mean, it's, you know, it's not by the year. You're seeing we've got a bunch of woke generals who push the jab into their troops. I mean, we've got troops constantly falling over with heart attacks now. And everything else, pilots who can't pilot anymore, and it goes on and on and on. And so the bottom, and our economy is clearly crumbling. You know, people keep talking about one day we're going to go into a recession. I think you already know, Michael, it's not going to be
we're
a recession.
We're going to
go like five mountain ranges beyond recession. You know, it's going to be, you know, old, like what our grandparents went through, but worse, because now we got a lot of other people. We've got a lot more fish in the aquarium. And a lot of these cultures are highly predatory, highly predatory, and they've been taught to be predatory specifically against people like us. It's coming. There's going to be a massive civil war in the United States. It's clear as day.
Now, that massive civil war that you're speaking of, will that be like an activation of a lot of the illegals or gangs like MS-13 that have crossed the border? Or are we also talking about extremists, you know, extreme Islam terrorists in the United States targeting Christians and perhaps Jews? Or, you know, is it going to be more the narco cartels working with the CCP targeting, you know, U.S. National Guard bases and infrastructure? Like, any idea what's more likely for that to look like?
All the above. I mean, this is a jungle. Nobody runs the jungle. And actually, when I was in the Iraq war and the and also in the Afghan war and some other conflicts, they're highly complex. It's not just, you know, Sunni versus Shia or Kurds versus Arabs or, you know, Syrians versus so-and-so. It just goes on and on. They become quite complex, like Southern Thailand, very complex. Philippines, very complex. And I was in Nepal, and that war, I was out with the Maoists for a long time. I wasn't actually in, I never wrote much about it, but I spent a year in Nepal. Again, very complex. There's clearly a whole sub ecosystem of Chinese coming through, who are coming through for something much broader. The Chinese are, now we see militant jihadist or militant Islam does wish to rule the world. They are ultimate globalists, but so is CCP. So, you know, there's competing globalists here. World Economic Forum, CCP, you know, Islamic Jihad that wishes to rule the world. And what's quite interesting here is the Chinese. For instance, I saw an article a few days ago about an archaeological dig in Honduras, because I watch archaeology because that's where I pick up some information war tips. For instance, I suspected that Chinese would be doing archaeological digs here in Central America, because what they'll do is either, you know, actually I've been told that the Chinese have been caught dumping artifacts into the sea around Japan, so that they can find them later. So what they do is they say, hey, you know, like this dig in Honduras, they say, hey, we found these artifacts. They're clearly from Chinese origins, or, you know, our cultures are overlapping with the Mayans or others. And then they say, hey, you're our people. So what the Chinese Communist Party has been saying is that the people that came over the landmass when, you know, the Bering Straits, the land connection, that they were all actually Chinese. And so all the Native Americans, whether it was Mayans or Cherokee or whoever, that they are all of Chinese origin, and that we stole their land. And so that the Spanish and the French and everybody else came and stole Chinese land, and that they're going, and that they're coming to take it back. So you see these Chinese coming, they are coming to take back what they consider their land.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on right now, including, you know, Zionists saying that God gave them the land that they're wanting to take from Gaza right now as well.
Yeah.
But your point on the Chinese is very important. You know, we have, you know, I'm just thinking, humanity is right now on the verge of a real breakout of nuclear war. And all it's going to take is maybe Israel firing nuclear artillery, if they have that, or launching a nuclear bomb from you know, one of their US-made fighter jets. And then it's, you know, anything goes at that point. Then it's Russian Kinzhal missiles. Then US aircraft carriers could take hits. And who knows what Iran has? And who knows what Pakistan might give Turkey in terms of nukes to use against Israel? You know, the first nuke goes off, we all better have a bunker at that point. That's the way I'm thinking. Yeah.
That's the way wars go too. You know, they often start like this, and then they just go out of control. If you've ever been in a firefight, of which, you know, I've been in a tremendous amount of firefights, they often start with just a couple of shots, right? Often it'll start like that. And I mean, sometimes they start with a lot of shots at once, but usually they start off with just a few shots, and then it builds. And before you know it, within a few minutes, you know, you got thousands of rounds per minute flying. You can't even hear. It's just one giant gunshot, right? And that's what this is at risk at doing, except on a larger scale. And keep in mind, at this point, if you're Saudi Arabia, you're definitely thinking about going nuclear, right? And UAE and all the rest must be seriously looking at it at this point, because no question. They don't want to be left with the only man not holding, glow sticks.
Yeah, exactly. Before we wrap this up, let me ask you to give out your website, your locals, or whatever else you want to give out. Go ahead.
Thanks, Michael. I'm on locals.com and I'm on X every day, you know, Michael underscore Yon, Y-O-N, and Substack, of course. And then most importantly, actually, I work behind the scenes providing information to people that they use on their shows. Because at this point, we don't have time. I don't have time to do it. I'm just trying to get this information out there so that people can prepare. And, you know, our government, by the way, if one of our aircraft carriers or ships gets sunk, I would not be surprised if our government immediately goes nuclear. Because this is a very irrational government that we have. These are like children that are on drugs, even. They're just completely out of control. They have no control whatsoever.
I share your concern, and I'm wondering, you know, if we make it to 2024 and, you know, perhaps a different administration, hopefully, in office, because I agree with you. And this current State Department, run by people like, you know, Victoria Nuland and Antony Blinken and so on, they are really irrational. I would call them lunatics or even sociopaths who don't understand history. They don't understand military assets. They don't understand economics, geography, or anything. They're just running around the world trying to bully everybody, and they're finding out that it's actually not working. I was reading yesterday, Russia, you know how strong Russia's economy became after the U.S. put sanctions on Russia and cut off Russia from SWIFT? All that did was force all of Russia's billionaires to invest in Russia. They couldn't send money out anymore. So the Russian industrial base just exploded. Now Russia alone is manufacturing something like 7 or 8 times more munitions than all of NATO combined, including the United States. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Remember those reports that the Russian economy will collapse next week, next month? And, you know, a lot of us were watching it going, I don't know, because you see, Putin is not insane, right? And the Russians are not insane. You know, and one of the things I've said to some of these people, and, you know, because I'm usually overseas, you know, they'll ask me about, you know, Putin or whatever. And I say, you know, I'm not, it's actually mind boggling that me as an American, like a very serious American to the core, would say, I actually think Putin is much more moral and sane than our president by far. Who would you trust your children with, Putin or Biden? I mean, you know, Biden's obviously not the president. He's just a meat puppet.
Clearly. Yeah. Or as you said before, the dog king. They put a dog king in place to insult us all. Okay. I know we have to wrap this up here. Any final thoughts you want to leave our audience with of sort of what we should be watching out for next in all of this?
Well, the invasion continues and it's increasing. It's not decreasing at all. It's absolutely
the invasion
increasing
of the United States.
Of the United States. And, you know, and Mayorkas, when he says there's no problem at the border, yeah, there's no problem because he wants an invasion, right? And he's clearly creating it. And he's openly doing it. And he says that he's doing it. And the bottom line is winter will be here soon enough. Where are all these people going to go, right? And the Dutch government has already warned their people that Dutch may have to take, you know, wayward travelers into their homes. And the Dutch are like, we'll never do that. Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, they will. Bottom line, at the end of the day, one way or another, it will happen.
I also read a story in the UK Daily Mail that said that some illegals that have been trying to live in Chicago are so disillusioned with the collapse of Chicago that they're fleeing back to Venezuela.
They should. Did you see that? Yeah, I saw the report. I thought you sent it to me, actually.
And I may have. Yeah.
And the bottom line is that I told a lot of Venezuelans and others coming through. I said, you're going to go up to the United States. You're going to get in a civil war. You'll be lucky to live. And you're going to be running back to your country. I've told many of them that. And they're like, they think I've lost my mind. I'm like, you'll see. You'll see. Yeah.
All right. Well, Michael Yon, we appreciate all that you're doing and all your travels. And how did it work out with the Mennonites there? You visited them last time we spoke.
So interesting.
What was that? Yeah. Belize? Where was that?
In Belize. And okay. The Mennonites are so interesting. Actually, I want to go back there and talk with them some more. You know, if the lights go out for the Mennonites, they're not going to notice. I mean, they got some good ice cream, though. They do own some. They have these ice cream stores in Belize, and Ann Vandersteel and Misako Ganaha went into one of them, and they sent me some video, and I said, "Well, come get me." And we went back there, and unbelievable, the Mennonites are the people in Belize love the Mennonites because they're so honest and they're good carpenters and they make good food and they don't even use electricity very much except for their ice cream stores and a few other things.
All right. Well, that's great to know. Great to know there are some stable human beings somewhere on the planet who aren't like carrying out genocide against somebody else.
The Mennonites, when you talk with them, you're like, hey, I'm talking with people that are not on drugs. You
know? Right. No, they're not on pharma all the time.
I'm talking with actual humans.
I know. It's so rare. All right. Well, thank you, Michael. We appreciate you and stand by. Let me just give out your information again. It's michaelyon.locals.com to find Michael on Locals. And then on X, it's, I believe, Michael_Yon, correct?
Yes, sir. Thanks, okay. Michael.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Stand by. And thank all of you for watching. Mike Adams here of Brighteon.com. God bless you. Get ready. Stay safe. It's going to get interesting from here forward. Take care. Hope you enjoyed that Michael Yon interview. This interview is sponsored by the Satellite Phone Store at SAT123.com. The Satellite Phone Store has satellite phones available right now. They make them very affordable with a monthly payment structure. Gives you a certain number of minutes. And then after your contract is up, you own the phone free and clear, and you have all your minutes that you haven't used because they roll over month to month. Now, why do you need a satellite phone? Because it's the most reliable form of communications when the power grid goes down or the telecom system goes down, which is what just happened in Australia. By the way, total failure of the comms system. The phones went down. 911 services went down. Hospitals were offline. The entire train system was offline in Melbourne. And internet was down. That just hit half of Australia. But people who had satellite phones were able to make calls. Because anywhere on planet Earth, if you can see the sky, you can make and receive phone calls using these satellite phones. Just go to SAT123.com to find out what's available now. They also have Bivy Sticks, which are two-way satellite text messaging devices. They're very tiny devices, very small, about the size of an ice cream sandwich. And they use Bluetooth connections with your phone, but they don't use the cell towers, but just to read messages and compose messages. But the messages are actually sent to the satellites via the Bivy Stick just by having it point at the sky. And it talks to the satellites, and that gets relayed back down to ground stations to send text to anybody's phone or to receive text from anybody's phone. You'll just get a phone number that will come to you through the satellites. It's just a regular-looking phone number, like a U.S. phone number. These Bivy Sticks can also be used to alert family members if you're lost or you need rescuing. You can pre-set up an alert list of people to be emailed with your geolocation if you decide to turn that feature on. And then by pressing an emergency button, you can alert everybody to where you are. Maybe you're lost. Maybe you need rescue. Maybe you're buried in an avalanche or a war zone. Yes, I mean, these devices will work in Gaza. They will work on a ship in the ocean. They will work in the deserts of Nevada. They will work anywhere in the world where you can see the sky. So if you want backup comms, I won't travel without them, by the way. I always have both a Bivy Stick and a satellite phone with me at all times in my vehicle. And if I ever travel by air, I would bring them with me as well, although I would have them turned off at that time. But you can get these now at SAT123.com. That's the satellite phone store. And their products and their solutions are saving lives right now all over the world. So give them a look and find out what they can do for you. Thank you for listening today.